This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Well, later on, we're going to take a look at Ramon Ramirez, president of the Oregon Farm Workers Union and immigrant rights activist for more than two decades. But first, close to 4,400 mechanics, cleaners, and maintenance workers at Northwest Airlines walked off the job August 20th, the strike called by the Independent Aircraft Mechanics Fraternal Association is the first major airline strike since the Northwest pilots struck in 1998. With us is Mark Taylor. Now, what I want to know is, under the threat of bankruptcy and in an increasingly hostile political climate, many industry unions have surrendered, taking massive concessions with little talk of fighting back. Well, in this climate, what necessitated or provoked the strike of the mechanics?
From AMFA's point of view, it's quite surprising to us that the rest of the industry has been capitulating the way that they have been. The reason why we decided to stand up for each other at Northwest is because that's what union people are supposed to do, is stand up for one another. When we realized and the company came out and started bragging that they had a plan in place for the last 18 months, they have been planning replacement workers, they've been training them. They spent in the neighborhood between $100 and $200 million to do this, to replace their seasoned workforce that has an average experience at Northwest of over 20 years, which actually matches their flying museum of about 20 years also. The average aircraft, the average age of the aircraft is around 20 years old. When the AMFA membership realized what the company was doing, we also realized that it had a fair amount of government cooperation. In order to pull off a plan of this magnitude, there has to be some assurances put in place early on. When the membership found out about that, their resolve grew extremely strong, and they decided that if Northwest wants to give it a shot, we're going to accommodate them. As you can see right now, sometimes the very best plans don't seem to go that well. The airline is struggling to make on-time departures. There's a large number of cancellations. And AMFA is extremely, extremely concerned about the safety environment that this airline is operating under. There's been multiple incidences that have been brought to our attention and the media attention. And these are just the ones that kind of escaped their grasp that got into the news media. As you very well know, what's going on right now are a lot of undocumented incidences, which we don't know about. We just had an FAA inspector fired in Minneapolis, St. Paul. This inspector was doing his job, and the FAA administration, his bosses, fired this individual for doing his job. The FAA has a level of cooperation with Northwest that is becoming alarming to us. We're telling passengers to stay away from Northwest Airlines. There's other carriers out there to fly. AMFA is extremely concerned with the safety issues. All across America, people are very familiar with all the outsourcing of jobs going on right now throughout our country.
Well, Mark, I want to just again emphasize there was like 14 months of preparation that Northwest made in anticipation of demanding these concessions from the workers and $100 million in strike preparations. At the same time, the airline claims that it got $3.6 billion in operating losses since 2001 and may go into bankruptcy. I mean, how do you juxtapose this stuff, the ferocity of the airline carrier? Is it really about losing the $3.6 billion in operating expenses, or does this become a real model, the job cuts and outsourcing part of a whole new business model that Northwest wants to use, similar or emulating, shall we say, the low-cost or non-union airlines like JetBlue?
Without a doubt. Northwest is a mismanaged corporation, like many corporations that you see in America, and they turn around and in order to save themselves, they ask for the workers to give back. At Northwest Airlines, the company is, in my opinion, going bankrupt. And they're turning this into a labor dispute. They're turning this into a model for other companies to follow. What the model's going to show other corporations is that this is most definitely not the way to go. When you have a unified workforce, and you have people that are willing to stick up for themselves and fight for each other, Northwest is going to prove to be a very interesting and a very challenging case. it's a lot easier and much more successful to get employees' trust and respect than try to undermine them. To me, this is just going to be a fantastic example of what corporate America shouldn't be doing, what our government shouldn't be doing. Basically, what we have here is people inside the company, little people that have too much money right now. And basically, the power got to them, and they're being taught a lesson that they didn't expect to receive right now. If this is used industry-wide as a model to break out the unions, if for any reason Northwest is successful, then other corporations will repeat this without a doubt.
I know there's antagonism between the, you know, the Aircraft Mechanics Fraternal Association, AMFA, which gained most of its members by decertifying IAM units. Now, Northwestern Mechanics left and Cleaners left the International Association of Machinists for AMFA in 1997. I want to know how that has affected the strike, and I can't help but remember how in 1981, how unions at airports crossed the picket lines of the professional air traffic controllers, known as PATCO, and the PATCO officers were hauled off to jail in handcuffs at the urging of President Reagan. And I don't want to frighten people and I don't want to be alarmist, but this is a very, very alarming situation. Is there another PATCO, or is there some basis for optimism? And how do we look at these contradictions amongst the unions, which have not been as supportive of their brothers and sisters as they should have?
I think what's very important to look at is everybody in their lifetime, different people come on at different times. We've told other unions on the property there is no animosity between us and AMFA. AMFA more than understands the predicament that they're in. They're intimidated. They're frightened. They're everything that we are, but that's part of finding courage and doing the right thing. AMFA decided that this is where the labor movement turns around. This isn't just a fight between the Aircraft Mechanics Fraternal Association and Northwest Airlines. This is where labor movement starts turning around in this country. Everybody is saying AMFA can go up against the hot airbag, which is Northwest. We can go up against the bully. And matter of fact, we're doing quite fine standing on our own right now as it is. The company will be filing Chapter 11.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the rest of the unions can see us standing tall. And at any time, they are free to join us.
And we should say Mark.
And AMFA will not do what they have done to us. We've already told the membership when it comes our turn, and we've actually written this down, and you can go to our website and see it. AMFA will support all other unions on Northwest property. That's what union people do. You put your differences aside, and you move together as a group.
And Mark, Mark, let me also say that while Northwest is certainly trying to put up a strong face, particularly having spent, as I said, 14 months and more than $100 million in strike preparations, last week they were forced to admit that they had to cancel 3% of their 2,900 flights. And this rate of cancellations is really unacceptable in the industry. So make no mistake, this airline is being sorely affected, and you shouldn't, both for political, moral reasons, and safety reasons, be flying Northwest. Now, I also understand there was a particularly virulent and aggressive security firm that was hired. Tell us about that.
They're called Vance Security. They're a worldwide security firm. You'll also find Vance in Iraq. And what the company did nationwide, pretty much, is to hire this firm to monitor the strikers. At first, they were walking between the strikers. They were agitating. They wanted things to develop where we would lose our permit to strike in front of Northwest facilities. And it didn't take, thank goodness, these guys aren't rocket scientists. And once we brought this to the airport authorities' attention, the airport authorities realized that, you know, this is what they're trained to do. And our guys realized early on what they were trying to do. And they put a separation, pretty much a healthy separation, so there would be no conflicts. And our membership is monitoring the Vance security to make sure that none of this nonsense goes on any longer.
Mark Taylor, what can we do aside from not flying Northwest to support our striking colleagues?
Public support is extremely important to us at this point. Just to understand that the fight that we're locked the battle that we're locked into right now between corporate America and the blue-collar worker. This is just the average worker sticking up for his simple, basic rights. And it's very, very important for the public to understand this, that we're trying to do the right thing here, and it's not just about us any longer. If this slide continues any farther, then the middle-class America, and everybody knows what the globalization economy market's going to do. It's the other countries raising their standard to America, and it's America's standards coming down to theirs. And we're starting to see this more and more every day as the days roll by. What they could do for us, we have a website, AMFA National, AMFANATL.org. On that website, you'll see many different ways of support that you can support the AMFA technicians at Northwest Airlines. Just your letters of support, just your verbal support is very important to us and to our members.
Mark Taylor, we thank you for joining us. Hold strong, and let's, as consumers, community activists, people of goodwill, and sister and brother workers, make sure we support this picket line and make sure that the corporations don't eke out from the workers the concessions to enhance their own profits that they are doing. And we've been speaking with Mark Taylor, who is with the Aircraft Mechanics Fraternal Association. Stay strong.
Thank you very much.
What's going on? There's a war zone here today out in the heartland, but the union's here to stay. Those multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true, but they declared a war on us right now, and by God it's up to you, 'cause there's a war on the workers. There's a war on the workers. There's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling the shots.
Workers' and immigrants' rights are under attack. Peikun says, fight back, fight back. We're joined by Ramon Ramirez, president of the Oregon Farm Workers Union and immigrant rights activist for more than two decades, and Peikun, the Northwest Tree Planters and Farm Workers United, have begun their organizing process for collective bargaining and contracts with the employees, and of course, how they're seeking to fight for meaningful immigrant reform. And it's nice to have you with us in New York.
Thank you very much. And I want to send a shout out to all our supporters in New York City who have supported Peikun, the Oregon Farm Workers Union, for years and years.
Why don't we tell our listeners who the workers are? Who are the tree planters and farmers in Oregon, and what are the particular issues they face as workers?
Oregon is one of those states that we're seeing an increase of immigration into our state, but for the most part, over the last 40, 50 years, Oregon has been part of a migrant stream where farm workers used to migrate from Mexico or from South Texas and California up to work the strawberries and cherries and the row crops and the hops and a number of other for the products like Christmas trees. So we're, according to the last census, we have about 180,000 farm workers in the state of Oregon. There's probably close to over 400,000 Latinos in the state of Oregon. We started off organizing the union back in the 70s. We actually started we started off as an immigration defense organization in Woodburn, Oregon, which is in the heart of agriculture, Oregon agriculture. It's a small little town, but it's the cultural center of our community. In our area, it's called the Willamette Valley. There's probably about 50,000 farm workers that live in that part of the state. The majority, I would say 95% of the farm workers now are either from Central America or from Mexico, the large percentage being from Mexico. We've had a number of farm workers work in the Willamette Valley since the 1940s. Many of these workers came up as braceros, which was contracted labor during the World War II, and stayed around till 1964. Being close to proximity to California, we were one of the states that back in the 60s when Cesar Chavez started organizing, what the growers did was to prevent Cesar Chavez from organizing in Oregon. and a number of the neighboring states created a bunch of laws that were unconstitutional, but created laws in the state legislature that prohibited farm workers from organizing. For example, one of those laws specifically said that you could not organize strikes during harvest time. That's kind of like the history of, in the state of Oregon.
One of the things that I found so interesting about your organization is when I think about organizing, I think about really engaging the power structure and empowerment of people as an issue. And I think your organization has really looked at how do you begin to empower agrarian-based immigrant workers and have taken some of your models from previous times. And I do want to hear more about it because right now, if you look at the the split in the AFL-CIO, a lot of it's about organizing or perhaps the lack thereof. But certainly what I don't hear on the agenda is what kind of organizing do you do to really begin to empower the base, the workers, and create a real workers' movement that has an element of self-determination?
That's a really good point. I would say that what we did is we got a page out of the old history of the labor movement in the United States and just started implementing what labor was 60, 70 years ago, which was the labor community union. One of the first things that we started doing is we had to come to the realization that the majority of folks that we were organizing had never been organizing. You know that saying that let's organize the unorganized. We were organizing the never organized, meaning that for the most part we were dealing with a workforce that was immigrant, didn't speak the language, who had a very little education in their home country, I think like third or fourth grade primary. And we had dealing with a workforce that was undocumented and never been organized in the traditional sense that, you know, really being part of a democratic institution and really playing, you know, part in that. So one of the things that we did was we really needed to spend a lot of time in developing, you know, a structure and building any kind of organization. You need to have a structure that takes into account, you know, some of the difficulties that of the people that you're organizing. So we spend years and years trying to build, like, worker committees, trying to educate and empower folks. Certainly, one of the things that didn't help us was we had all these laws in the state of Oregon that prohibited farm workers from organizing. So one by one, using, you know, the committees and using the fact that we had to empower the folks, gave us an opportunity to get folks engaged in tearing down those walls of institutional racism. We mobilized hundreds of people to our state legislature. They participated in hearings, and we did a lot of lawsuits. And in, I think one of the things that we did was that in 1986, when the union was actually formed in 1985 with about 100 workers, and then in 1986, we had the passage of the Immigration Control Reform Act called IRCA, which had a legalization provision in it. So we were able to legalize a lot of farm workers under the Seasonal Agricultural Worker Program. And in fact, we built the union around that. And we were able to increase our membership at that time to about 2,000 members. But still getting them involved, you know, building worker confidence. We bought our building back in 1988. So that workers had a place where they can go, fear from retaliation, you know, some place they can go and strategize and meet without, you know. And that was really important because one of the things that we did was we were able to build a solid foundation of trust in the community that whatever the union said it was going to do, that we completed it. And we set a structure in the organization because we were dealing mainly with people from different states, and we had a huge indigenous population, especially from the states of Michoacán, in Mexico, and also in Oaxaca. We set up a structure that didn't play favoritism to anybody. We were pretty strict about, you know, charging dues, so we created a due system in the union. Cesar Chavez taught us that if you're going to organize work, that workers had to feel that that organization was part of them and that they had to pay for it because they had to feel like they owned it. And we had to create the institution so that there was participation and people felt like that was their union. So we did that early on, and I think that one of the successes of Becun has been around the fact that we've always maintained an associated membership where, you know, to be part of the union, you have to pay your dues. It's minimal. It's right now it's $15 initiation, and then it's $10 a month. And then we have contracts now, but so that, you know, workers pay out of their check, right, when they get dispatched to farms. But nevertheless, we created those structures, right, and we were pretty consistent in that so that over 20 years, we built a solid foundation.
One of the critical issues anywhere in the country is exactly that, the organization and actually getting contracts for the farm workers. And I should mention within that, there's a boycott of Gallo Wines because they still haven't entered into the contracts they should with too many of farm workers in this country. But do tell us about some of the contracts that you've been able to get with collective bargaining agreements. And also, we should take a look at immigrant rights and reform, which is very much on Pekun's agenda.
Let me just step back a ways to talk about, in order for us to get to contracts, you see, farm workers are one of the only workers in the United States that are not part of the National Labor Relations Act. I believe domestic workers are also excluded.
That's right.
What this means is that we don't have a legal mechanism set up. You know, so if we go to a farm and we get the majority of the farm workers there to sign cards, there's no agency, there's not the National Labor Relations Board that could certify that election like that because we're excluded. The only way that we could get contracts is through pressure, economic boycotts. So in order to get farm workers to go from, you know, being immigrants, undocumented, coming up to Oregon, and then being part of a union, and then moving them from empowering them to take actions on farms, farm workers got to feel supported. So in order to do that, we started building a movement. And that movement wasn't only about labor rights, but the movement was really broad in general because we understood very clearly from the onset that immigrants have a lot of needs. For example, they don't speak the language, so we needed to get them to speak English. I mean, one of the most important things that of every immigrant group that has come to the United States over the last 200 years is learning the language. So we did that. We had a lot of housing issues. I mean, every time we went out on strike, you know, we were able to get people that had lived outside the farm to go out on strike. But the people that lived in labor camps, because they were controlled by the employer, they would never come out because they didn't know anybody. They were indentured. They owed all this money. They didn't know the language. They don't know the rights. So we started getting involved in building housing for farm workers with a very objective of getting them out of those labor camps. Labor camps in Oregon are like apartheid in South Africa, or were like apartheid, where they had complete control of the workers. Workers did not have a say in where they lived, and many of them didn't even know where they were at. We would tell people, where are you at? You know where you're at? What state? No, I don't, you know, they didn't know anybody. So we got involved in housing, and we've built some of the best housing in the country for farm workers. We did a lot of immigrant rights stuff because a lot of our members were immigrants, so we started providing immigrant services to our members, trying to get them legalized whenever we could. So we have a pretty good service center for farm workers. And then we started building a women's organization to address the needs that they had, especially around sexual harassment in the workplace, domestic violence issues, and issues like that. So we have a very, very good organization of women who have now spun off the union and actually have become a nonprofit 501c3 that does a lot of economic development work. They're sort of like a worker co-op because during Christmas time, they make these beautiful Christmas wreaths, and then they sell it, and then they whatever money that they make, they pay themselves. Of course, they, you know, they have a seniority process. It's like a union. They pay way above minimum wage. The minimum wage in the state of Oregon right now, thanks to the farm workers and to other workers, is $7.25 an hour, and it'll be going up because we have a cost of living index. So we have done that. So the road to collective bargaining hasn't been like the straight up typical union kind of thing where, you know, you do a hit or you do an organizing campaign at a particular place of employment and you get the cards filled out, you get the majority, you start your organizing campaign, and then you're off, right? No, with us, we had to build a movement for the last 25 years, you know, in order for us to put enough political pressure, develop enough economic pressure to force the growers to come to the negotiating table. And we did that through a 10-year boycott of the largest food processing company west of the Mississippi, which is Norpak Foods, who is located in Oregon. It's a 250-member cooperative, and we were able to get them to the negotiating table in 2001. But in order to do that, we had to build this movement.
Well, Ramon, let me just, because our time is growing to a close, and I want to get into some of the immigrants' rights issues specifically that are on the agenda, and of course find it very exciting that we're dealing with a labor organization that has built bridges, I shamelessly say, between the labor and the community sector and taken into account the full personage of the person who is the worker, and clearly issues about gender and so many other things, which I think is critical to the organizing process.
Yes.
Tell us about some of the immigration issues that are being advocated.
Primarily what we're doing is we've been advocating for Ag Jobs, which is a compromise comprehensive bill around for farm workers that would give legalization to farm workers. In addition to that, we've been active in the DREAM Act that would give students the right to continue their education. Many of these kids are undocumented and were brought at an early age and grew up as Americans and cannot continue their education because they don't have the legal documents. And then the last thing that we're promoting at this point is the Kennedy-McCain bill. We have some issues with the Kennedy-McCain bill, but overall, I think, you know, it's a way that people can get legalized. And while it's a proposal, it still needs a lot more worker protection standards, we believe, in there. But, you know, it's a good start. It's a good discussion. And so, you know, we've been supporting it. So that's what we've been working on over the last several years to get immigration reform passed, because there's probably about 9 to 11 million folks out there that are undocumented. These are hardworking folks. They pay taxes, and, you know, they work hard to make America prosper. And so these folks definitely should get a shot at the American.
And we should tell people the website so people can find out more about PECUN and workers and immigrants who are under attack, but who do fight back, fight back.
We have a website. It's pcun.org. And in there, you know, you can read about our history. You know, the other thing I didn't mention is that as a result of, you know, 20 years of organizing, we have secured collective bargaining agreements for farm workers in about 5 or 6 farms in Oregon. So we prove that immigrants, if given, you know, the proper strategy and can be empowered, that we can be successful and do successful labor organizing.
Ramon Ramirez, president of the Oregon Farm Workers Union, thank you for providing us with information from Oregon's farm worker movement.
Thank you very much, Mimi, for having me, and shout out to all our supporters out there in New York City.
This has been Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report Special.
Good workers, good news to you, I'll tell of how the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on, boys? Which side?